Chapter 28. Before this year, Barrett seldom spent any time on his office balcony. He had far too much work to allow any time for rose sniffing or horizon gazing or whatever people did outside. To the extent that he enjoyed the balcony at all, it was only for the way it impressed his guests. Lately, he was spending hours each day out on the balcony, smoking, mostly. He was up to 2 packs a day, and had given up all pretense that this was a temporary setback. But he was also horizon-gazing. On a clear day, he liked to imagine he could see the building that housed his old law firm. The building that built him, you could say. Hard work, but simpler times. The Code of Professional Responsibility spelled out all the rules that governed the conduct of lawyers in private practice. It was so easy to parse through an ethical dilemma in those days. Simply consult the rules. And if you were still uncertain, anonymously request an opinion from the Ethics Committee. You got an answer, and you conducted yourself accordingly. But there were no rules in the corporate world. Well, perhaps there were too many. Either way, everything was murkier. Maximize shareholder value used to be the guiding principle, but now there were all these other duties. Reduce your carbon footprint, and promote diversity, and remove the glass ceiling, and lean in or lean out, or do the hokey pokey or some such nonsense. It made his head spin. He hoped that time away might help. He was leaving for Paris tonight. It would be a pseudo-vacation to placate Melanie, who was still in a snit over his failure to deliver on the Met Gala. Marcia had arranged for her to be faded and fitted by the top designers in the city. For Barrett, the trip meant an opportunity to speak to Madame directly about recent events, to confirm her blessing and secure her cover. And the biggest incentive of all, it would place him well away from the scene of the crime when the Lambert problem was finally resolved. An alibi, if you like. Marcia's voice sounded through the balcony speaker. "Mr. Barrett, your car is here, and your luggage has been sent down." He took one last drag on his cigarette. "What about my security?" "It's Colby today, and he's right here." Barrett stubbed out the butt in the planter box and went through to Marcia's desk. A large black man wearing the company blazer was standing at attention. Almost all the bodyguards seemed to be black these days, Barrett thought. It was the same with the cops and the soldiers. If that race war ever happened, he was pretty sure he'd be on the losing side. Marcia handed him his attaché, working papers for the plane ride. "You have the first quarter reports," she said, "plus the latest draft of the new contract with Luke Rafferty."
"And that, ID badge?"
"It's in there," she said coolly. Marcia gave nothing away. "I hope you and Mrs. Barrett have a wonderful time." Out on the street, the regular driver was loading the bags into the trunk of the company limo. Melanie was taking a separate limo because her luggage wouldn't fit in this one. At least 3 of her bags would be traveling empty. She planned to fill them with her shopping. Colby opened the passenger door, and Barrett gave a start when he saw someone else in the back seat. Jack Culligan.
"Hope you don't mind," Culligan said. "I thought we could talk on the way to the airport."
"About damn time," Barrett said, ducking in.
"Yeah."
Culligan pushed a button to raise the privacy screen as Colby took his seat beside the driver.
"That's what I wanted to talk to you about. I have to apologize for the way I kind of went AWOL on you. Truth is, I've been having a hard time getting my head around all this."
Barrett frowned as he buckled his seatbelt. "Some of us don't have the luxury of time to wallow."
"I know. It's just that Lucy's death, and now with Lambert out..."
"I'm taking care of the Lambert problem." The limo pulled away from the curb.
"How?"
"Tony Lowe knows somebody. Here, stateside." Culligan's forehead creased.
"Somebody who..."
"Yes." The evening rush hour had ended.
Traffic was light as the driver merged onto the highway.
Gee, I don't know, Barry. It's one thing to manufacture, manipulate. That's all we did. Besides, what if Lambert actually did it? What? Just because we repackaged the evidence doesn't mean she didn't actually kill Lucy.
The more he thought it,
the more likely it seemed to him, and the better he felt about everything. Huh. She could come after me or you next, Jack. We have to neutralize the threat. Culligan turned to the window and didn't speak for several minutes. Barrett checked his phone and read a text from Melanie. She was waiting for him in the Premier Members Lounge at the airport. She'd ordered a bottle of Dom. It's more than that, though, Culligan said finally. It's that whole business in Myanmar. I know I went along with it at the time, but the more I think about it, well, especially after those men drowned in the typhoon. Look, I understand, Barrett said. He'd been thinking through these same questions during his hours out on the balcony, and he felt reasonably happy with the answers he'd come up with. Happy enough to share them with Culligan. Here's the thing, Jack. You have to view everything in context. The context of the prevailing norms in that time and place. Think about it. George Washington owned slaves, but nobody's agitating to take his face off the dollar bill or to rename the capital. Because slavery was a cultural norm. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal." But he owned slaves. Hell, he even fucked his. But he's still revered as one of our founding fathers. Let's face it. This old damn country was founded on slavery, because that was the culture of that time and place. Well, guess what? Barrett was feeling expansive. In pockets of Asia today, slavery is still part of the culture. Multinational corporations like ours are always being told to respect and comply with local standards and traditions, and that's all we did when we monetized those assets. Admittedly, this was an ex post facto rationalization. When they'd made the decision, all they'd been thinking about was saving the company and thus their jobs. But why was that so wrong? Factory workers were allowed to fight for their jobs, even when violence sometimes erupted. Why not the workers in the executive suite? Capitalism depends on the exploitation of capital, he said. And that includes human capital. Culligan was squinting hard. I don't know, Barry. It's all just a matter of degree. A sliding scale. At one end, you might have the men on those fishing boats. And at the other, you have a young lawyer working 20 hours a day in hopes of making partner. They're all being exploited. Minimum wage workers, unpaid interns, the whole gamut. But those men, held captive on a boat in the middle of the ocean for upward of 3 years? Yes, yes, it's deplorable. But keep in mind, if not for those men on those fishing boats, Americans would have to pay twice as much for pet food. Anyway, most of those people, men and women, would have ended up being trafficked even if they'd never come to work at PST. It's just a fact of life over there. But not over here. And a lot of those girls ended up... No, that was a mistake. Tony admits he dropped the ball there. But to compensate, he's doing this next bit at a discount. This next bit being... Barrett didn't answer. You've still got eyes on her, right? Culligan didn't answer either. When's it gonna happen? I don't know. I don't know when or who or where. But I know this. Barrett slapped Culligan on the knee as the limo pulled up to the terminal. We'll all sleep a lot better when it's done.
Chapter 29. A manila envelope was propped against my front door when I got home late one evening. Alice dove for it, shook it, sniffed it, and took it out into the street to open. She came back and handed it to me. Just a document. It's harmless. There was no cover letter or any other indication of the sender. Nothing but a copy of an email from Nelson Ledbetter, CEO of Northstar, to Ned Bartman, Mark's rival for class council. In it, Ledbetter confirmed our chat and alluded to an attachment showing that little anomaly we discussed. The attachment wasn't included, but I could guess what it was. A spreadsheet showing the discrepancy in fourth quarter earnings that Bartman supposedly unearthed all on his own, the discovery he was hanging his hat on for appointment as class counsel. Now we had evidence that he'd been hand-fed the information by Ledbetter. It had taken three drink dates with Joshua Mattson, and by the last one, I'd had to be a lot less subtle. It could happen anywhere, I'd told him. A young lawyer working third chair on a major lawsuit discovers that his boss made a dirty deal on the side, a deal that could reap him millions of dollars. Does he reveal it to the other side? But he'd finally come through for me. When I heard Mark return to the building, I called him with the news. "Come on up," he said. And I went back outside and in the front door and up the four flights of stairs. He was waiting by the open door, barefoot, as always, after hours, but otherwise fully dressed in white tie and tails. He'd been to a charity do that night, an event chaired by his wife. "Where'd you get this?" he asked as he read the email. "Anonymous delivery, presumably from a whistleblower inside either Bartman's firm or Harrington's." "Well, what do you know?" he grinned. "An honest-to-God smoking gun. It really happened. They really did a reverse auction." "We don't have a witness to authenticate it," I pointed out. He waved a hand. "We don't need one. I'll confront Ledbetter with this email on the stand and drag out all the lies in his deposition. He'll fess up."
"Then you'll be appointed class counsel."
He spread his arms wide.
"Last man standing. Great work, Shay. You really came through for me."
"I need a new assignment. What about the Genco case? I could help Phoebe."
"Nah, that case would be a waste of your talents. Let's keep you on Northstar. Now that we're locked in as class counsel, there'll be plenty for you to do. And if not, I'll think of something else."
"Anything but CDMI," I reminded him.
"Right."
A frown crossed his face, but he wiped it away with a smile.
"Wanna come in? Have a celebratory nightcap?"
"Thanks, but I should head back down. Good night." I turned and walked very deliberately to the elevator. I could feel him watching me from his doorway as I pushed the call button. The cage arrived, the cylinder opened, but my feet faltered. I did a quick about-face to the stairs.
"No."
Mark came at me in three quick strides and took me by the elbow.
"You can do it, Shay."
He steered me back to the elevator.
"No. You can do anything. You've proved that."
"I'm not ready."
"I'll go with you," he said,
and he stepped on and pulled me into the narrow cylinder with him. The door closed, and when the cage descended, I lurched and stumbled against him. And as he reached to steady me, I flung my arms around his neck and kissed him. He wasn't surprised. He'd been expecting it, waiting for it, taking it as his due. He didn't accelerate, neither did he resist. When the elevator landed on the basement level, I had to use my keycard to unlock the door, and I had to lead him by the hand into the bedroom. No one could ever accuse him of making unwelcome workplace advances.
"You're sure?"
he said, before he undressed me. And I could tell it was a practiced bit of his foreplay, a rhetorical question he was certain would be answered in a breathless affirmative, which was exactly how I answered. He lay back on the bed and waited for me to straddle him, but it didn't take long for him to give up the charade that I was the one in charge. He flipped me onto my back, and I stared at the ceiling as he rose and thrust above me. He was hinged at the hips, levering up on straight arms and down on bent elbows. The image of a lever rooted in my mind. He was a lever, trying to pry information out of me. When his pace quickened, the image changed, and I thought of an oil pump jack out on a windswept Texas prairie, drilling deep to tap into my well of knowledge about CDMI and how he might bring it down. Sex was a tool, his greatest one, or so he thought. What metaphor described my own sexual behavior? That was easy, I thought, as I wrapped my spider arms and legs around him and drew him deeper into my cliched web. Afterward, cheek to chest, I murmured, "Stay the night?" He kissed the top of my head.
"I wish, but we have to be discreet. You understand that, don't you?"
He assumed I was smitten, that my ardor would have to be controlled. I gave him the sigh he was waiting for. "Of course, I understand." He got dressed in his white tie ensemble, and I clung to him as he padded barefoot to the elevator. His waistcoat and shirt hung open, the mother-of-pearl studs were in his pocket, and I slipped my hands inside, against his skin. "I'm so grateful we had this time, Mark." I lifted my face to his. "I'm so grateful for everything." He smiled and kissed me again. "I mean it," I said, breathing against his lips. "I wish I could repay you. I wish I could give you what you want." He leaned back in the circle of our arms, watching me, waiting for the next part. "I can't betray an attorney-client confidence or violate my NDA. You know that." His eyes narrowed. He heard the "but" in my voice and waited for it. "But," I said, "there's some information I came upon through another source, not through CDMI, and I've reviewed the rules, and I think I can share this much with you." "No, I know I can." I rose up on tiptoe to kiss him again. "What?" He breathed against my lips. 4 women are being held in the ICE detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey. 1 is Thai, 1 is Cambodian, and the other 2 are Indonesian. You need to take translators and go there and get statements from each of them, and video it, and do it fast before they're deported. Deep, puzzled creases carved his forehead. "Why? Who are they?" "I'll text you their names." "What do they have to do with CDMI?
I can't say anything more. Just do it, please.
I gave him a nudge into the cage and reached around him to push the 5th floor button. "Good night," I called as the door slid shut. "And thank you." When he was gone, I went into the bathroom and used the bidet and stood under the rainfall shower for a long time. I had one happy thought as I fell asleep that night. I wouldn't have to climb the stairs anymore. At least that much of the pretense could be over.
Chapter 30. Barrett had a car and driver at his disposal while he was in France, and he also had a body man to open doors and clear paths and generally serve as a factotum. But he dispensed with all of that for his mission today. He took a cab to the Montparnasse station and rode the TGV to Tours. The company had a small satellite office in Tours, but he didn't stop by or alert Eve that he would be in the area. Instead, he hired a car and drove himself deep into the chateau country of the Loire Valley. Because it wasn't his car, he didn't care about lingering odors, and he allowed himself to smoke as he drove. The deep breathing helped him relax, even if only enough to offset the jitters he got from the nicotine. His mission today was twofold. The short-term goal was to update Madame on recent developments and get cover for all that had happened and was yet to happen. They needed to circle their wagons. The long-term goal was to demonstrate Phil Duval's failure to meet the short-term goal and to plant the seeds for a changing of the guard. Or rather, to fertilize the seedlings he'd already started. This campaign was a long and slow one. As was this drive. Madame's chateau was well off the beaten path, and he had to follow a circuitous route through small villages marked off with crumbling walls, past vineyards and forests and meadows of wildflowers dancing in the spring breeze. The rustique charm was lost on Barrett. He railed to himself that the chairman of a major international corporation should be resident at that corporation's headquarters. The chairman of a major international corporation shouldn't be living in seclusion under elaborate security measures and with a single gatekeeper. Although, he reconsidered, if the guard did indeed change, if he became that gatekeeper, he thought he could make it work. When the rental car's GPS told him he was getting close, he pulled off to the side of the road next to a field dotted with golden bales of rolled hay. It looked like a platter of brioche for a giant. He turned the rearview mirror his way and carefully pressed two adhesive strips of mustache onto the skin above his upper lip. He was already wearing a Burberry safari suit identical to one Phil Duval often wore. Now he added a pith helmet and sunglasses, and when he studied himself in the mirror, he thought he looked like a fool. Exactly like Phil Duval. He drove on. A single track road led up to the gatehouse of Madame's chateau. It was a two-turreted stone structure with a central arch to drive through, or rather to stop at, since the guard came out and stood directly in the path with his palm out. Barrett lowered his window and passed out the ID he'd cloned from the company security files. "Bonjour, Monsieur Duval," the guard said. He returned the ID and stepped aside with a gallant arm wave through the arch. "Continuez, s'il vous plaît." It was a lucky break. A guard who knew the name and costume better than he knew the face. The sun dimmed as the lane led through a dense stand of trees. Then it brightened again as he emerged into a swoop of manicured lawn that curved around a pond with a fleur-de-lis fountain at its center. Then around another bend, and the chateau came into view. It was in the classic style, a melding of Gothic and Renaissance architecture, with a steeply pitched roof toppled by corbelled chimneys and pierced by gabled dormers, all of it stone-carved with elaborate ornamentation. At the center was a large round tower topped by a conical roof. Barrett pulled up beside the arched entry. A maid opened the heavy wooden door as he got out of the car. She was dressed in a white tunic and pants and white soft-soled shoes, and he was a bit disappointed that she wasn't wearing the Halloween version of a French maid's outfit. He stalked toward her in his heavy safari boots, as if on the trail of big game. She said something to him, but even though he had some rudimentary French, the only words he recognized were, "Bonjour, Monsieur Duval." "English, s'il vous plaît," he said. She bowed to admit him into a cylindrical reception hall. Its curved walls were painted with chinoiserie murals. "You are lucky," she said, in slow, careful English. "Madame is having a good day today." He raised an eyebrow. "Has she been ill?" She gave him a puzzled look. "You may go up," she said, and pointed toward the stairs. He realized he was expected to know the way. If he asked for an escort, his cover would be blown. He eyed the carved stone staircase and followed its curving path up to the gallery above. The mansion was big, but not enormous. He ought to be able to find Madame's salon. "Merci," he said, and started up the stairs like he was scaling Kilimanjaro. He congratulated himself as he reached the landing above. His ruse had worked. He'd made it past two separate gatekeepers and was about to have a private audience with Madame. He took off his sunglasses and peeled the mustache from his upper lip. He'd met Madame several times during his early days at the company, and she'd always behaved warmly toward him. Still, she might be angry that he'd arrived without warning, and that she'd had no time to prepare her toilette. He decided his best defense would be a good offense. He'd burst in pleading urgency, No time for niceties, he'd convey. A true emergency had compelled his visit. He headed down the central upstairs corridor. It was lined with mirrors, a scaled-back version of the famous hall in Versailles, and he could picture Madame striding down the corridor as if it were a fashion runway. Doors stood ajar along the hall, giving him a view into each chamber. Each one was empty. He wondered if he was on the right floor. Madame's salon might be on another floor up. Then he heard a strange sound, a rhythmic, high-pitched keening. The wind through one of the chimneys, he thought, except that there wasn't even a breeze stirring outside. Could it be Madame operating some kind of sewing machine? Did she still do that? He cocked his head and calculated the direction and turned that way, down a smaller hallway. The keening grew louder, and he saw a light coming from the room at the end of the hall. He followed it to the doorway. Inside the room was another maid in the same white uniform. She was spoon-feeding a pale-haired child whose back was to the door. Barrett's jaw dropped in surprise. He'd never heard of a child in Madame's life, let alone a grandchild. But that explained the maids dressed in white. They were actually nursemaids. It might also explain why Madame chose to live this bucolic life. The better to raise a child in. The maid looked up with a bright smile.
Ah, Monsieur Duval.
The spoon paused in mid-flight, and the keening grew louder still.
It is nice to see you, she said,
her voice raised above the din.
Madame so enjoys your visits.
Barrett came into the room, and the maid stood to greet him. But she stopped abruptly.
Wait, who are you? You are not Monsieur Duval.
He looked from the maid to the child. She was clutching a naked baby doll to her chest and rocking back and forth in her wheelchair. Her hair wasn't blonde, it was white. And her face, the face that once graced 100 magazine covers, was skeletal.
Madame? He breathed. Get out! Get out at once! The maid screamed.
He came closer. The woman's eyes were vacant, and a line of orange drool trickled down her chin.
I shall call security!
The maid, or rather the nurse, hurried to the telephone table across the room. Barrett wondered if he should identify himself, declare his name and position and his right and duty as corporate counsel to meet with the chairman of the board. But he couldn't speak. He could only stare.
How long?
He stopped. He had to clear his throat.
How long has she been like this?
The nurse was shouting into the telephone, rapidly and in French. The old woman's distress seemed to grow. Her rocking turned frenetic. Her keening turned to screams.
How did you get in here?
The maid said, apparently relaying the demand from whoever was on the other end of the telephone.
Are you alone?
Yes, Barrett answered. As he said it, he realized it was true. There would be no cover for him. There were no wagons to circle. He was completely alone.
Chapter 31. The next morning, I found Phoebe in a huddle with Louisa at the reception desk. I stopped and raised an eyebrow at their frantic whispers. What's up? We don't know where Mark is, Phoebe said. Louisa was wide-eyed. He left me a note saying, clear my calendar today, cancel everything. He took Lonnie and the limo, Phoebe said, and now he's not answering his phone. Weird, I said. We hashed it out. Phoebe would cover the hearing in Mercer. I would handle the conference call in Ralston. Louisa would cancel everything else. I returned to my office downstairs and logged on to the firm's server and spent 30 minutes learning the Ralston case, then the rest of the morning poking through the entire file on the Genco case. Like the Palmer case against CDMI, it was a derivative action attacking the incumbent management of the company. Under the terms of the soon-to-be-finalized settlement agreement, Mark would appoint 5 new members of the board, who would then install new management in the executive suite. I studied that mechanism very carefully. I changed into running tights and a tank top, and at 11:30, I dialed into the Ralston conference call. I made Mark's excuses and wrested a minor concession from opposing counsel. At noon, the call ended, but the line remained open for the hour allotted, and I left my extension open. Anyone watching the switchboard or reviewing the phone logs would assume I was still on the call. Alice would have been happy to go running with me. She also would have been duty-bound to report my movements to Mark. I slipped out the French doors into the garden, then stopped at the back gate. The alley was clear, and the surrounding rooftops empty, so far as I could see. I darted out and sprinted around the corner and flagged down a cab. I took it through Central Park, all the way to the river, where I stationed myself near the Boat Basin Cafe, and waited for Nelson Ledbetter to appear. Something I'd learned over the years when taking depositions, you can often glean as much from the witness's casual, off-the-record banter as you can from his actual testimony. One thing I'd learned last week while Nelson Ledbetter shot the breeze with Dick Harrington was that every day at this hour, he left his office at North Star and took a run along the Hudson River Greenway. He was a tall man, and I spotted him at 50 yards, his head bobbing high above the pack. I let him pass, and when he was well ahead, I cut out onto the trail and ran to catch up. I gave him a quick backward glance as I overtook him. Then I did an exaggerated double take. "Oh, hello," I called as I slowed my pace and fell into step beside him. "It's Nelson Ledbetter, right? Shay Lambert, I took your deposition last week." He peered at me. His face was red and streaming with sweat.
"Oh, hi,"
he puffed. "How've you been?" I asked cheerily, loping along.
"I don't think I'm supposed to talk to you."
He could barely talk anyway.
"Us being adversaries and all."
I laughed. "But we're not anymore. Mark pulled me off the North Star case. My work is done, as they say." Ledbetter seemed to relax at that news, though he was still blowing hard.
"Yeah, I heard you found that email."
"You sure didn't make it easy for me, though." He hesitated. "But I understand. You had to sell it, right?" He huffed a laugh. "Anyway, he just put me on Genco, so now we're not adversaries, we're allies." I winked.
"Oh, so you know about—"
I nodded, and thank God, current management is a shipwreck.
"I got a good team lined up," he panted. "We'll turn it around by 2015 fiscal year end."
And there it was, my hunch confirmed. All I'd based it on was some cryptic marginalia in the draft settlement agreement. But it all made sense. Mark would be installing new management at Genco, so with the presidency up for grabs, why not offer it to someone who could help him sew up his appointment as class counsel in the North Star case? He'd made an offer to Ledbetter, conduct a reverse auction with Ned Bartman, leak an incriminating document, and become president of a bigger and better company than North Star. The whole thing was a setup of Ned Bartman, even if Bartman was already angling to do a reverse auction. It was like framing someone for a crime he actually did commit. Here was the weapon I'd been hoping for. Ledbetter would probably want to report our little conversation to Mark. But with Mark incommunicado today, he wouldn't have a chance until after I'd already deployed it. "Oh, there's my phone," I told Ledbetter, slowing to a trot. "Nice talking to you." I'd planned that as my exit line, but in fact, my phone was buzzing. I fished it out of the pocket on my thigh as Ledbetter saluted and ran on. The call was from the office. I started walking east as I answered, off the greenway and heading for the city streets. "Sorry to interrupt your conference call," Louisa said. "I have someone named Joe Riley on the line. He says it's urgent. At the mention of Riley's name, my heart rate shot up higher than when I was running. The police must have finally deciphered the documents in my briefcase and figured it all out. Patch him through, I said. At that moment, I spotted Lester Willard. He was watching me from behind the wheel of a blue sedan parked at the curb, facing west on a one-way street going east. I scanned the block for escape routes, but there weren't any. I had a sickening realization that I shouldn't have come here without Alice.
Ms. Lambert, Riley said as the call connected.
Detective. I broke into a run again and sprinted past Lester's car. I headed for the cross street at the end of the block. I heard his car door open behind me.
It's about your husband.
My breath caught, but I kept on running, slaloming around trash cans and fenced-in sidewalk trees. I kept my eyes peeled for a cab, but in the corner of my vision, I saw Lester breaking into a run after me.
He's in the hospital, Riley said.
A flash of yellow came through the intersection, and I shot my arm straight up. The cabbie swerved to the curb, and I dove into the back seat. Detective Riley was waiting for me at the hospital entrance.
Where's your muscle?
He asked, his eyes searching the street behind me. I'd intended to call Alice from the cab, but when I didn't see Lester following, I'd thought better of it. Mark didn't need to know that I'd rushed to my husband's bedside any more than he needed to know about my ambush of Nelson Ledbetter. I gave her the day off, I said. Riley's shaggy eyebrows met in a frown, and he hustled me off the street and into the hospital lobby.
They've moved him to the 6th floor, he said,
leading the way to the elevator bank. What happened?
Overdose.
I nodded. No surprise there. But why were you notified?
I wasn't.
He pushed the call button.
I'm the one who found him.
The doors slid open, and I followed him onto the elevator.
Unresponsive, shallow breathing, lips and fingers blue. All the signs.
I nodded again. I knew all those signs too. I'd committed them to memory, just in case. Riley pushed the button for the 6th floor.
The ER docs pumped him up with naloxone and IV fluids. They say he'll be okay.
I heard the skepticism in his voice. I agreed with it, but I still wasn't following. You just happened to recognize him? They'd never even met. He shook his head.
I've been looking for him, for a while now.
The elevator doors opened on the 6th floor, and he swung his arm out to hold them apart.
Room 615, he said.
David lay flat on his back, so thin under the blue cotton blanket that his body looked like nothing more than a faint swell in a dead calm sea. A white sheet was turned back in a cuff over the top edge of the blanket and tucked in tight up to each armpit. His eyes were closed, and tubes looped around his ears and into his nostrils. Another tube ran from a needle in his hand to a plastic bag on a pole. An oximeter was clipped to his finger, and a blood pressure cuff wrapped around his arm. His chest rose almost imperceptibly with each shallow breath. His skin was gray beneath the stubble of his beard, and his cheekbones jutted out like mountain crags above the hollows in his face. I crossed the room to the window and leaned against the sill and watched the rise and fall of his chest. It was as if I'd wandered into a stranger's room. I tried to retrieve a memory of him the way he used to be, the way we used to be, and it came to me, our happiest moment. After the first night in our new apartment, when we rose naked to the dawn and stood hand in hand at the window, ready to meet the world and ready to conquer it. I could see myself so clearly in the memory. I could see all of Manhattan spread out in living color before me. But when I turned to look at David in my mind, he was only a flickering image, as insubstantial as a wisp of cloud. He seemed barely more solid as I gazed at him in the hospital bed, He was a shell of what he used to be. Or maybe he was always a shell, and I'd simply filled him with my own manufactured perfect man. I'd taken Mrs. Casco's advice. Wear the face you want the world to see, and that's who you'll be. And tried to apply it to David. But it didn't work that way. I'd put the face on him that I wanted to see. I'd created an illusion and expected him to become it. Disappointment was inevitable. David, I said. He started at the sound of my voice, but he didn't open his eyes. Tears squeezed out from between his lashes. David, I said again. I'm sorry, he whispered. I am so, so sorry. I didn't speak again, and he finally opened his eyes and moved his gaze through the room until it landed on me by the window. Don't hate me, Shay, please. I don't hate you, I said, and it was true. I didn't feel hate or anger or even disappointment anymore. I looked at him and felt nothing at all. It's not my fault, he said, and the tears streamed out of the corners of his eyes and down his temples to drip onto the pillow under his head. I couldn't help it. I'm not like you, Shay. I'm not strong like you. You're right, I agreed. We're nothing alike. I thought it would last forever. He started to sob, and I knew he wasn't talking about us or our marriage. He was talking about the money Barrett paid him to sell me out. How much was it? 30,000, he whispered. I nearly laughed. Barrett must have been feeling biblical when he settled on that figure. $30,000, 30 pieces of silver, the price of betrayal. A doctor swept in from the corridor and stopped when she saw me there. Oh, you the wife? I shrugged. She was a black woman in her 40s with a severe hairstyle and a stern mouth. In quick, terse terms, she laid out David's prognosis. He would need to remain hospitalized until he was stable and his detoxification complete. She could recommend several reputable addiction treatment centers. Fees varied. She left me with a fistful of brochures and a final warning. He can't do this many more times. The next time might be the last. I understand, I said. She left the room, and a nurse replaced her. There were papers to sign and a medical history to provide. And when David's hand shook too much to write, I signed the papers. And when his voice shook too much to talk, I answered the questions. A team came in soon after to do another EEG, and I left to give them room to work. I was surprised to find Riley in the corridor outside the room. He was on his feet, leaning against the wall with his arms crossed. His eyes were closed, and he looked like he was sleeping. Asleep on his feet, like an old horse in a stall. I walked past him to the end of the hall and got my phone out and called Dev Kapoor. He knew what to do even before I told him. I'll be there as soon as I can round up an ADA and a court reporter, he said. He added, this would also be a good time to send over the expert video report. I deliberated for only a moment. Yes, I decided. It was time to catch all the spinning plates in the air and set them down in their places. And Dev, those papers we discussed? Printing out as we speak. A different nurse was fussing with David's IV when I returned to his room, so I took up position next to Riley in the hall. By the way, he said. He wasn't asleep after all, though his eyes were still half closed. I finally figured out those papers in your briefcase. I closed my own eyes then, with a silent sigh of relief. But all I said was, those are confidential business records, detective.
Yeah, right, he scoffed. Is that why you made it so hard on us? It was like some kind of crazy scavenger hunt with all your little post-it puzzles.
Would you have believed me if I flat out told you? He thought a minute and shrugged.
Probably not. Certainly not enough to kick it to the feds. But they have it now.
Ah.
The Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. They can manage all the multi-jurisdictional stuff. Plus, I hear they have an informant, wired up.
Really? I wondered who it could be.
So you won't have to break your precious duty of confidentiality.
Riley said the last part with a sneer. The nurse backed out of David's room, wheeling her cart of equipment, and I headed back in. But I stopped at the door. I guess I should thank you, Detective, for finding him and bringing him in.
I got lucky.
I shook my head. He's the one who got lucky. David was asleep again, or pretending to be, and I sat by the window and waited him out. Dev texted me his ETA, and I confirmed. At 4 o'clock, Mark Ivins sent me a text and fired off another 4 in quick succession. When I didn't reply, he started calling at 5-minute intervals. I turned my phone off. David woke at 5, and I got up and stood by his bed. Here's what's going to happen, I told him. Some lawyers are coming to take your deposition. They're going to ask you about the money and that stack of resumes, and you're going to tell the truth. He nodded. You'll have to stay here a few days, but then you have a choice. You can go into rehab, a good one, and I'll pay for it.
How?
I have $50,000, free and clear. His eyes opened wide. If you decide on rehab and complete the program successfully, then we'll find a place together and do our best to work on our marriage. Or, he watched me carefully. You can sign the divorce papers my lawyer's bringing over, and I'll give you the cash. $50,000, free and clear. His eyes fell shut, and his chest rose up and down for a long moment. He turned his face away before he spoke.
I'll take the cash,
he said. I nodded. Deal. Dev arrived with a woman from the DA's office. Riley knew her, and the two of them went into a huddle in the corridor while the court reporter set up her machine, and Dev went over the proceedings with David. Then Riley and the ADA joined us, and David raised his right hand and told everything that happened the morning of February 2nd. That there was a knock on our apartment door, and a tall black man came in holding $30,000 in cash in one hand and a stack of documents in the other. That there was a second knock later that morning when the police arrived with the search team. And finally, that he, David, opened a drawer and told them, "Here, take a look at this." "No further questions," Dev said. "Nothing from the state," said the ADA. And it was over. After the others were gone, Dev brought out the divorce papers. David had to sign his own name this time. He managed, and with that stroke of a pen, our marriage was over too. It was nearly 7 when I left the room, and Detective Riley was still in the corridor. "Don't you have any other cases?" I said.
"As a matter of fact, no."
He turned and walked with me to the elevator.
"This is my last one."
"You're retiring?" His mouth twisted in a semblance of a smile.
"More accurate to say, I'm being retired."
"Oh."
"It was supposed to happen a month ago. I lobbied for an extension so I could finish this case."
"What's left to do?"
"I have to fall on my sword."
I gave him a puzzled look as the elevator doors opened. The car was packed, and we rode in silence to the ground floor. But the moment we were alone again and heading for the exit, I said, "What do you mean?"
"My final act will be to write up a CYA for the DA. Admit that we made a mistake when we charged you. With enough mea culpas so the DA can dismiss the charges without getting any egg on his face."
I stopped dead in the lobby. He went 3 more steps before he realized I wasn't beside him. He turned around and nodded.
"We're dismissing the charges against you,
and we're charging Ingram Barrett with obstruction and making a false statement. Not that he'll serve a day in the state penitentiary. The federal case will preempt ours.
I let my breath out in a big, slow exhalation. Everything hanging over my head, every burden dragging me down, they were all gone. I had only one more spinning plate to catch before this whole ordeal would be over. I felt lighthearted, and a little lightheaded, too. Riley held the door for me. Outside, dusk was settling over the street, but the air was balmy. It was a beautiful May night. "Thank you, Detective," I said. "I owe you for this, for all of this."
"You don't owe me a damn thing. We did screw up. We never sourced the gun to you, and we swallowed Barrett's lies about motive. Gun!"
When he yelled the final word, I thought he was talking about the ghost gun in the elevator, and I was shocked as he rammed against me and knocked me off my feet. A pop sounded, and a light flashed, and the hospital doors behind us shattered into a geyser of twinkling shards of glass. I landed hard on the sidewalk, with Riley sprawled half on top of me. An alarm began to screech in the hospital lobby, and through the fading light, I could see a line of smoke curling from the muzzle of a gun. Behind it was a man, small and Asian, and running at us with the gun pointed straight at my head. He was only yards away when a big black man made a flying tackle through the air and slammed him to the ground. The gun went skittering across the pavement. I wrenched myself out from under Riley and scrambled to my feet. He rolled to his back with his phone out and panted, "Shots fired," as the black man dug his knee into the other man's spine and wrenched his arms behind his back. I squinted at them through the dusk. "Lester?" I said.
"Yes, ma'am."
"What are you?"
"He's been following you for days," he said. "And I've been following him."
Something else went skittering across the pavement. A pair of handcuffs, tossed by Riley to Lester, who grabbed them and snapped them on the other man's wrists.
"NYPD's on the way," Riley called.
He was still flat on his back, and I went over to grab him by the hand and haul him up. He got to his feet with a loud groan. "I guess I owe you now," I said. He rubbed his shoulder with a wince of pain.
"You got that right.